Basically, you can't not breathe with your diaphragm pretty much. You know, a lot of people say, oh, diaphragm breathing or not diaphragm breathing. Actually, you're always using your diaphragm to breathe. It's just how, what kind of a state is the diaphragm in? Is it able to relax adequately, you know, at the end of a normal exhalation, or is it always in a semi-inhale position, which some people are? And then there's the issue of diaphragm strength. Do you know, is your diaphragm nice and thick and strong, or is it weak and thin and puny? Do you know, and a lot of people say after COVID or after having had issues, you know, with their health, particularly their respiratory health, they can sometimes develop a very weak and hypotonic diaphragm, or people can develop a hypertonic, excessively tense all the time diaphragm.
Hey there, friends. Welcome to the Happy Habit Podcast. I'm Matthew. We're here every Monday and Thursday talking all things health and well-being. A reminder, we are now on YouTube and on Instagram if you want to check out the videos of the Happy Habit Podcast episodes. Just search for the Happy Habit Podcast on both platforms. Today, I'm talking with Dr. Rosalba Courtney. She is an osteopath who did a PhD in dysfunctional breathing. She is an integrative breathing specialist who helps people with poor breathing habits and those who suffer from dysfunctional breathing. In this episode, we define functional and dysfunctional breathing. We discover how the body's pH is affected by the breath. Expect to learn what the optimal number of breaths per minute is. We find out whether we should be breathing through our noses or our mouths. We explore the many roles of breathing over and above the exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide. Expect to learn the significance of nitric oxide in the body and its relationship to breathing. Learn about the importance of the diaphragm in the mechanics of breathing. Plus, we hear tips to help us become better breathers. Well, Dr. Rosalba Courtney, you're very, very welcome to the podcast. Breathing is a bodily function that is arguably the most vital of all, considering we can't even go a few minutes without taking a breath. Indeed, breathing fulfills a lot of different functions, and most people, however, seem to overlook its significance to our overall health. Why do you think we take breathing for granted?
Well, that's an interesting first question. Why do we take it so much for granted? I think some people are kind of actually overly concerned with their breathing. Do you know what I mean? There can be people who are just too vigilant and too aware of all the nuances and changes of their breathing because their breathing system doesn't work too well. And so those people are overly concerned with breathing and don't take it for granted. And mostly those of us who breathe well don't think about it because, you know, there's a lot of stuff to think about in life, isn't there? But I think that this sort of understanding of breathing as a kind of tool that you can use, you know, for self-regulation and for healing and for health optimization, I think the interest around that has really peaked in the last, well, shall we say, you know, the last decade perhaps, or particularly the last few years.
Is this primarily because of the amount of research and knowledge in relation to breathing has, as you say, peaked because of the internet age, really?
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, since the beginning of time, people have known that breathing, you know, is a tool, something that you can actively modulate. It's like deep in the human experience, you know, it's in the language of most cultures. You know, the word for breath equates with life force and energy and vitality and spirit, you know, and soul. And you know, they've done research showing that across all cultures, you know, the most common thing that people do to change their state is to change their breathing, you know, take a deep breath or so on. So, but I think it's hard to know exactly why it's kind of gotten the increased status as a wellness therapy. Maybe there's just been a general increase in interest in, you know, self agency, you know, around wellness type processes, and and breathing kind of was part of a bunch of stuff, you know, like people becoming more conscious of exercise and diet and stress reduction and so on. And breathing was just one of those things. I mean, I don't know about you, but when we grew up, most people didn't bother doing anything about their own personal wellness, did they? People kind of went to the doctor if they were very, very sick. Otherwise, you just took what life gave you, including in terms of your health.
Yeah, you just got on with it. You just got on with it.
Got on with it. You were lucky to be alive, right?
Dr. Courtney, you're an osteopath. You did a PhD in dysfunctional breathing. And well, can you tell us what exactly dysfunctional breathing is?
Ah, so dysfunctional breathing is breathing that doesn't efficiently or appropriately fulfill the functions of breathing, you know. So dysfunctional breathing would be a way of breathing that doesn't promote well-being and health, but kind of gives you symptoms and contributes to sort of dysfunction and ill health rather than health.
Because most people don't realize that breathing has many different functions. It's not just a situation where it is responsible for the exchange of gases like carbon dioxide and oxygen. It has many, many more functions.
Yeah, that's right. It's such an interesting thing, breathing. It's the major, you know, it drives pressure changes throughout the body, which influences the flow of fluids, you know, like blood, venous blood, cerebrospinal fluid, lymphatic fluid. It's a way of changing brain rhythms and, you know, like the patterns of brain activity will entrain with the breath. And, you know, it's very much a key to voice, vocalization and speech, of course. It's super important for just creating these kind of rhythms and patterns within the body, you know, oscillating rhythms that affect how different systems in our body talk to each other. So it's like the conductor of the orchestra in terms of the rhythms and oscillations within our body.
I heard Wim Hof talk before about how breathing affects the body's pH. Can you talk to us about this?
Sure. So the two organs in our body that regulate pH the most are the lungs and the kidneys. And the lungs do it by controlling carbon dioxide retention or expulsion. And the kidneys do it through the retention or expulsion of bicarbonate. So, you know, like carbon dioxide is like an acid in the body. And bicarbonate's like an alkali. So the lungs and kidneys work together to regulate your pH, to keep it around about 7.4, and there's only a very narrow range of pH that's compatible with health. So a lot of people have this idea, and I think I've even heard Wim Hof say it, that what we need to do is to alkalize our body, you know, that the more alkaline your body is, the better. And he says, do the big breathing because it will make you more alkaline. And but the thing is that what we really should be going for is balance, you know, to have this balance of pH around 7.4, because to be too acid or to be too alkaline is to create problems for ourselves. So, for example, if people, you know, do, you know, Wim Hof's a great technique and a lot of people really love it and get a lot of benefit and improve their well-being from doing it as a daily practice. But, you know, it's actually about breathing more for a short period of time. And so that will make your body more alkaline. And in the short term, that's fine. Your body will balance and compensate and it's all beautiful. But if you're always breathing more than you should because of stress or disease or anxiety or something, and your body becomes too alkaline, you know, in terms of losing too much carbon dioxide, then you develop something called respiratory alkalosis, which first thing that happens is it makes your nervous system sort of twitchy and jumpy, okay, more prone to, you know, muscle spasm and more prone to kind of overly sensitive, you know, neural reactivity in the brain and throughout the body. So you might get twitches, you know, there's actually a test for alkalosis, you know, like this, tap on the cheek and see if you twitch, you know, and people with seizures, the alkalosis can contribute to seizures. and so on. So it's all about the balance, really, and not wanting to disparage Wim Hof at all, because I'm actually quite a big fan. I think it's really great, but it's just all about understanding that it's the balance, you know, and that's something that we can work with breathing.
I've heard you say that 1 in 10 of us are overbreathers. Is this alkalosis a symptom then of overbreathing?
Yeah, that's a figure that I've come across in a few places. So, yeah, it seems that in modern society, you know, that we're a bit prone to chronic overbreathing, but there are also people who underbreathe, so it can go the other way as well.
When we talk overbreathing and underbreathing, are we talking then about shallow breathing as opposed to diaphragmatic breathing, if we can get into those?
Underbreathing sometimes looks like rapid shallow breathing, actually. Do you know? So overbreathing can look like rapid shallow breathing, but some people can overbreathe with doing too much deliberate deep slow breathing. Actually, it's possible. So, but it's all in the end about the level of kind of arousal in your system, do you know, in your nervous system, and just the general level of arousal physiologically that you might have, you know, secondary to inflammation or a chronic infection, or just your body shifted into a state where it's never kind of, you know, it doesn't naturally go back to its rest state for one reason or another.
And how do we measure dysfunctional breathing in somebody who would, let's say, present in your clinic there? How do you, are there tests you do in order to determine that they are suffering from dysfunctional breathing?
Yep. I've got a whole sort of protocol that I use. So like my idea of dysfunctional breathing and sort of a model that came out of my PhD, research that I did applying a whole lot of measures of dysfunctional breathing to like 85 people and then seeing how those measures correlated. And what came out of that research was that people could have dysfunction in one dimension or another. People who are very severe tended to have disturbance in all dimensions, but people with mild dysfunction or particular uniqueness might just have dysfunction in one dimension. So those three dimensions are biochemical, which is about the acidity, the alkalinity, the pH, you know, the oxygen, the carbon dioxide. So you have to measure that. And you measure that by measuring oxygen and carbon dioxide most easily in the clinic. You can use a simple pulse oximeter, and then you can also use a simple nasal cannula to measure exhaled carbon dioxide to see how that is at rest and how it responds to various challenges. Then the other dimension of breathing is the biomechanical, which is all about the breathing pattern, the biomechanics of breathing. So you can look at things like how the nose responds to an inhalation, you know, does it open? Does it collapse? What kind of postural changes occur when the person's breathing? What's happening with their diaphragm, and how's that diaphragm coordinated with other breathing muscles? And so I've got some simple tools and tests, you know, that I've developed, some of which I've validated. Like there's a special test called the MARM, the Manual Assessment of Respiratory Motion. A lot of the physios are now using a tool for breathing pattern called the Breathing Pattern Assessment Tool. That's another one. Then we can use things like breath holding, like how long can you hold your breath till the first urge to breathe, till the first involuntary movement of your respiratory muscles to your most extreme, you know, ability to maximal capacity to breath hold. So that will tell you different things about breathing. And then you've got this whole thing about breathing perception. Do you know, which is the psychophysiological dimension. Do you perceive your breathing as pleasant or unpleasant? Do you overperceive it? Like, are you hypervigilant to your breathing? Or are you insensitive with low perception and unable to perceive your breathing, even if you're about to, you know, go into a state of, you know, dangerous state of hypoxia, which some people do. So some people have this problem with very low ability to perceive their breath. They're kind of disconnected from the body and its sensations and disconnected from the feelings of the breath.
You mentioned the diaphragm there as a muscle. How important is it in the actual ability to breathe and breathe correctly?
Yeah, the diaphragm is it's the biggest and the most important breathing muscle, and it's operating, you know, day and night, and it's hugely influenced by all the different things that regulate and control our breathing patterns. So if I was to shock you or scare you, even without thinking about it, your diaphragm would respond, right? It would, you know, flatten and tense. People, basically, you can't not breathe with your diaphragm pretty much. You know, a lot of people say, oh, diaphragm breathing or not diaphragm breathing. Actually, you're always using your diaphragm to breathe. It's just what kind of a state is the diaphragm in? Is it able to relax adequately, you know, at the end of a normal exhalation, or is it always in a semi-inhale position, which some people are? And then there's the issue of diaphragm strength. You know, is your diaphragm nice and thick and strong, or is it weak and thin and puny? Do you know, and a lot of people say after COVID or after having had issues, you know, with their health, particularly their respiratory health, they can sometimes develop a very weak and hypotonic diaphragm, or people can develop a hypertonic, excessively tense all the time diaphragm. And people can also develop kind of issues with the diaphragm where it's not very well coordinated with postural muscles or other muscles of breathing. Am I making this excessively complicated?
Not at all. No, that makes perfect sense. I spoke with somebody who was a specialist in postural restoration recently, and he spoke at length about the importance of the diaphragm and how it was affected by poor posture. So I know it makes complete sense if you think about it.
Because, yeah, that's right. Your posture affects the diaphragm, the position that it goes back to. So if you've got kind of got, I know in the Postural Restoration Institute, they're really big on what they call the ZOA. Was that person American?
Yes.
Did they say ZOA? Okay. Which we would say ZOA, or actually we just say zone of apposition. And that's really like, how well, in the context of what I was just saying, how well does that diaphragm relax, you know, at the end of exhalation? Is there enough, you know, pressure through the abdominal wall to help move that diaphragm up into its domed position where it's got a good ZOA or zone of apposition?
And I'm presuming through the course of your treatment of somebody who's presenting with imperfect breathing, you help them retrain their diaphragm, because ultimately the diaphragm is a muscle, so we can train a muscle. Would that be the case?
Yeah. It's yeah, that's right. You can train a muscle, and you can really kind of work on the whole breathing system so that it's all working together. Do you know? So for example, if I take a breath in, there are, you know, the diaphragm responds, okay, like via a nerve called the phrenic nerve, which then fires the diaphragm. But it's really interesting because there are other nerves that will fire just before the diaphragm fires to open the upper airway. And sometimes with dysfunctional breathing, the problem is just kind of the way the upper airway is integrating with the diaphragm. So it's the diaphragm's super important, but it's also about the coordination sort of throughout the whole system. And very often people with dysfunctional breathing, their main problems are extrathoracic, you know, outside the thorax, through the larynx, pharynx, and even the nose. So if you're really trying to retrain breathing, you're wanting to work through that whole breathing system, which is anatomically, functionally, and neurologically linked.
It seems that there's very much an intrinsic connection between the nervous system and the way we breathe. In your line of work, when you're treating patients, would you advise in some instances for them to also see a therapist to help them deal with their psychological well-being? Because ultimately, if somebody is in a poor psychological state, that affects the nervous system, which would then have a huge influence on their breathing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And the interesting thing, though, is that there's really this two-way, you know, relationship between the brain, nervous system, and breathing, so that this, you know, thinking, feeling, and kind of general kind of nervous system arousal affect breathing. But it works the other way as well, where breathing affects the brain, emotions, and the general arousal of the nervous system. So you've got this two-way thing. So breathing becomes this lovely thing that you can consciously control to influence the nervous system. A lot of psychologists are starting to work with breath, you know. I mean, not starting to, they probably have for a long time, but it's becoming more common practice that they will give patients who are anxious or who have panic disorder or, you know, some kind of trauma through their nervous system, that they will give them breathing techniques to, you know, settle themselves down and regulate themselves. So it's becoming quite a common practice. And there are some great little techniques and stuff that you can do, but it can get tricky as well. There's a, like everything, you know, there's a simple layer, a nice simple layer. And then there's another layer, of greater complexity where, for example, a lot of people who are anxious, they're given this. I see these patients every week. They come to see me and they go, I've been to see my psychologist. They've told me that I need to do these breathing exercises, but I just can't stand them. I can't bear it. I can't do those. I can't focus on my breath. It's really uncomfortable and it distresses me. So then you need to work a bit more indirectly, you know, through the mind and movement and posture and through the quality of the attention that you pay to the body and also how you deal with pleasant and unpleasant sensations, welcoming the pleasant but not being overly avoidant of the unpleasant. So it's kind of, if you, and if you really work with it in a sophisticated way, you've got a really great way in to the brain and nervous system. But some people really need talking and strategies and a psychologist, you know, or a really good psychotherapist to help them with the cognitive emotional side of things before you can make progress with the breathing.
In my research for this interview, I came across the term nitric oxide again and again and again. What significance does nitric oxide have in terms of breathing? Because it plays many different functions and many different roles.
So you keep coming across that people would refer to nitric oxide mostly in relationship to nasal breathing,
exactly,
right? Yeah. So people say, okay, like you need to breathe through the nose because the nose will increase nitric oxide. And it's true. You know, there is nitric oxide produced throughout the whole airway. It's produced in the throat, mouth, the lungs, and it's also produced all through the nose, but a lot of it is made in the sinuses, you know, which are those bones, the holes in the bones of our cheek, forehead, and deep inside our skull. We've got sinuses that produce, you know, this, you know, a type of nitric oxide. And that nitric oxide, when you, you know, create kind of a bit of disturbance to the air turbulence within the sinuses, then you will, you know, produce a bit more nitric oxide. And they say even 40%, up to 40% of airway nitric oxide can be produced in the paranasal sinuses. So, and that nitric oxide's important for its immune functions, like it's antibacterial, antiviral, antifungal, and it helps to dilate blood vessels. So it helps in the delivery of oxygen, because in the lungs, when the blood vessels dilate, you can pick up more oxygen because blood flow and airflow can match better. So that's one thing. But nitric oxide's also majorly produced. It's produced in every organ. You know, it's produced in the kidneys. It's produced in the brain. It's produced. A lot of it is produced within blood vessels, within the endothelium of blood vessels. And the level of nitric oxide strongly affected by things like physical activity and weightlifting and, you know, where you really got shear forces moving through the circulatory system. And my feeling is that some of those strong breathing techniques, even like Wim Hof, are probably really increasing nitric oxide, but not from the sinuses, but maybe from, you know, the lungs themselves and from the blood vessels, because all of a sudden you've got this very dynamic thing going on that's causing an increased kind of, you know, mechanical forces, you know, which are kind of what will stir nitric oxide to be produced.
I spoke recently with an ENT specialist and then with another doctor who specialized in treating patients suffering from sleep apnea. And both of those people spoke about the importance of nasal breathing as opposed to the mouth breathing. I'm presuming, given the antimicrobial effects of nitric oxide and other benefits of nasal breathing, that you'd probably come down on the side of nasal breathing being most important over and above mouth breathing.
Oh, yeah, for sleep apnea? Oh, yes. For everything, really. But, hugely important in sleep apnea. It's there are some people who, if they can just stop mouth breathing at night, you know, their snoring and sleep apnea improves. And because it's not just because of turbulence here in the nose, but the way it affects, you know, the collapsibility of the upper airway, like behind the tongue and in the throat. So if you can nasal breathe with your tongue up, that whole upper airway stays more open at night. It's really important. And, you know, you've got people on CPAP machines, and if they can't nasal breathe, they don't get as good result with the CPAP machine. Often they can't tolerate it.
So many people here in Ireland and in many countries around the world suffer from asthma, for example. Are we able to give people like that, in addition to whatever treatment they're getting from their doctors, are we able to give them breathing exercises in order to help them strengthen their diaphragm and their ability to breathe more healthily?
Oh, absolutely. People with asthma, something like 30% of them have, you know, dysfunctional breathing, which meaning that they've got symptoms that are coming not from the disease itself necessarily, but the symptoms being really contributed to by biomechanical factors related to breathing, biochemical factors related to breathing, or psychological, psychophysiological, perceptual aspects of breathing. The same with COPD, people with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, you know, that smokers get when they get older and their lungs are losing their stretch and they're starting to get more collapsible. And you can make, even in COPD, dysfunctional breathing really plays a role and adds to the, you know, to the suffering and the poor response to medication and medical treatment. So it's often alongside, you know, your, you know, medical treatment and the medication for those things. It's also really important to improve general fitness, particularly in COPD, like general muscle strength, but also to correct dysfunctional breathing, to make sure that people are not over-breathing or hyperinflating their lungs or using their breathing muscles in a poorly coordinated manner, you know, helping to ensure that they can nasal breathe more often and to a greater extent during exercise. And it can make an absolutely massive difference to some people. It can really just help them get control of their, you know, condition when they're not able to control it well, you know, using conventional medical treatment. And I'm not saying that one would substitute the other, like that you need no medical treatment, just work with your breathing, because I don't think that's true. But certainly, you know, being aware that you, as well as working with the, you know, the drugs and the bronchodilators and the anti-inflammatories, if you also work with breathing, you can really, you know, improve quality. Some people, massive improvement in quality of life. Most people would get some greater improvement in quality of life if they also work with, you know, breathing, well-constructed breathing exercises.
Is there an optimum number of breaths that people should be taking, for example, per minute?
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, that the range varies from, say, 9 to 14 breaths a minute would be what you and I would probably be breathing right now. And some people are breathing much faster than that. You know, they're up around 20, 18, 19, 20. And sometimes that's an adaptation to something going on in their lungs or their heart. And so you don't know for sure that that's definitely wrong. But most people do better with breathing a bit more slowly, do you know? And then there is a special rate of breathing, which I think you may have heard about, called resonance frequency breathing, which is where you're breathing at around somewhere between 3 to 7 breaths per minute, or averaging about 5.5 breaths per minute, which is not how we're meant to breathe in everyday life. But we're meant to relax a lot, like we're meant to sleep at night, and we're also meant to go into periods of rest, you know, to restore ourselves during the day. And this resonance frequency breathing, this breathing at 5.5 breaths per minute, would be what people do when they're really relaxing, you know, and what people, they say, they found that some prayer, you know, and some poetry and children's nursery rhymes and certain things like that and certain types of classical music tend to get us breathing at about 5.5 breaths a minute. And it seems like across the world, people have discovered that this particular type of slow breathing can kind of put us into a special state to help regulate and restore, you know, our energy and our equilibrium.
Which is exactly what most people are looking for. Before I let you go, Dr. Courtney, because time has almost run out on us today, can I ask you to give myself and some of the listeners some tips to help them come to terms with their breathing and perhaps improve the way they breathe?
Yeah, I think one of the first bits of advice is that realize that healthy functional breathing is variable. Okay, so you shouldn't really over control your breathing. You should expect your breathing to be different when you're feeling emotional or excited or whatever. We're not all meant to breathe like monks at 5.5 breaths per minute. You know, it's really okay for the breath to vary and sometimes to move into the chest and sometimes to move into the lower rib cage, sometimes with a soft belly to be in the belly, sometimes with a firm belly to be in the back. So that's one of my first messages, is always like, don't get obsessed about always breathing in this perfect way where it's always, you know, perfectly controlled lower ribcage, belly, 5.5 breaths a minute. It's sort of explore your breath a little bit. Bring some curiosity to seeing how your breath changes as you, you know, change posture and movement. That being said, most people can benefit from dropping their shoulders, you know, and connecting with their body and slowing the breath a little bit. And one breathing exercise has been around for a very, very long time because a lot of people are hyperinflated as well. So they're trapping air in the lungs. So it's often really nice if you're wanting to relax is to just, you know, first of all, connect with the breath exactly as it is without judging it as being, you know, wrong. It's just been reflecting what's been going on with you most likely. And then just drop your shoulders. And just watch your breath and notice how when you soften your body and relax, how the breath begins to slow. And just enjoy that feeling of the breath slowing. And it might not be 5.5 breaths a minute, but if it can be a little bit slower than it was. And you really bring your attention to it. So you feel it at different points of your body, like feel it, feel the breath in the nose and feel the breath in the movement of your chest, you know, rib cage and belly, while also holding that intention to keep your breathing muscles relaxed and to breathe a little more slowly. That'll just be a nice stress reduction thing to do without becoming hypervigilant or over controlling or over judgmental of your breath.
Terrific. Stress reduction, I think, is something we could all do a little bit more of. Thank you so much, Dr. Rosalba Courtney. Really appreciate all of your advice today, all the way from Australia.
So nice to talk to you all the way in Ireland.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the Happy Habit Podcast. If you're enjoying tuning in and listening to this series, please like, subscribe, share, and do leave the podcast a positive review. It really helps us out immensely. Until next time, stay happy.